advisement. Next is State versus Roger Coville. May we please have appearances in the matter of Roger Coville.
Good morning, Your Honor. Paul Heinzel, Assistant Somerset County Prosecutor on behalf of the state.
Deputy Attorney General Larry Mendez on behalf of the Attorney General.
Good morning, Your Honor. Daniel Rocco, Assistant Deputy Public Defender on behalf of Mr. Coville.
Welcome, counsel. Mr. Heinzel, please go ahead.
Your Honor, I'd just like to reserve time for rebuttal.
That's fine.
Thank you. In State versus Kane, this court couldn't have been more clear that in changing 27 years' worth of precedent as to the use of expert testimony in drug trials, its ruling was to be prospective in nature. Your use of the phrase going forward in qualifying your ruling is something that this court frequently uses to signal a rule applying to future events. And more importantly, it has a precise legal meaning in this very context, and one you've expressly held to denote a ruling that's prospective in nature. And for that proposition, I'm citing this court's opinion in State versus Dock, where you addressed the Artwell ruling that forbade the future use of defense witnesses appearing in prison guard, and the in prison garb, and the court looked to the language in Dock from Artwell that says, quote, going forward, a trial court may not require defense witnesses to appear at trial in prison garb. And your opinion in Dock looked to that very language and said that, quote, the court made clear that its ruling proscribing defense witnesses testifying in prison garb was prospective only. Well, that should have been the end of the matter. 5 years later, you used the exact same phraseology in Kane to describe the effect of your ruling. We think that was about as clear a signal as you could ask for in describing a prospective ruling.
But you are conflating, I think, retroactivity and pipeline retroactivity.
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think when in Doc, when they said going forward means prospective only, I don't think that allows for a pipeline retroactivity interpretation.
Why not?
Because prospective only means not going backwards. It means prospective from this day forward.
But it seems to me that pipeline retroactivity simply means we've got a series of cases that have been in the pipeline while this issue was coming before this court. Usually retroactivity means we're not going to go back 30 years and bring in all of those cases.
Well, that's full retroactivity, Your Honor. But this court has always differentiated and know we can apply something prospective only, as the court said in Dock, or pipeline retroactive or fully retroactive. And prospective may apply to these particular defendants and future cases, but you've never used the word prospective to apply to pipeline retroactive. That means you really are applying it going backwards to trials that have already happened.
So let's take your definition. I have Kane open. I want to ask you a question about it. About what parts of Kane going forward applies to, whether it applies to all of it or like one piece of it.
Well, that's
you know what I'm talking
yes,
about.
Yes, I do know what you're talking about.
So
I'm going to get to that in another part of my argument.
Well, why don't you get to it now?
No, I think your use of the phrase going forward.
Because it was at the end of the discussion, and this is the part of Odom that we were specifically reversing. Mm-hmm. I'll just read it so everyone will be aware. We now join those jurisdictions that limit the scope of expert testimony in drug cases. Going forward, in drug cases, an expert witness may not opine on the defendant's state of mind, whether a defendant possessed a controlled dangerous substance with the intent to distribute is an ultimate issue of fact to be decided by the jury.
Well,
so that was the end of Section C. And then Section D begins on hypothetical questions.
Yes.
Go ahead.
So, yes, your use of the phrase going forward was for hypotheticals that ultimately ask the expert to opine on the hypothetical defendant's state of mind as to whether he was possessing these drugs, with a hypothetical that tracked the facts of the case and whether those were possessed with intent to distribute, because you said that's really usurping the function of the jury. And I agree, that's the portion, so that gets to Detective Belgrave's testimony, which we'll get to in a minute. Detective Dockery was not testifying along a hypothetical that was asking him to opine as to the defendant's or the hypothetical defendant's guilt. He was just going into whether, you know, possession of 5 cell phones, 4 of which were prepaid with little or no call history.
Okay, you're making a distinction between Dockery and Belgrave?
Correct.
Okay, but you agree Dockery was asked the ultimate question and a hypothetical question?
Dockery, I don't believe that was true. I think there were some questions going back and forth, but I think he was asked whether that was behavior consistent with the manner in which cell phones are used, or that was consistent.
I think he's asked, and this hypothetical question is indicative of conduct commonly associated with possession with intent to distribute cocaine.
Right. That wasn't meant to track all the facts of the case and then provide an ultimate opinion testimony. It was whether use of cell phones was indicative of conduct that's commonly associated with drug distribution.
Doesn't the hypothetical begin with the package and the 1,006.6 grams and 3 cell phones on his person and 2 are prepaid and so on?
It does. It ties in the quantity of drugs. But in the portion of Kane that says hypotheticals aren't to be used anymore, you said the experts can refer to the facts of the case, including the quantity of the drugs involved.
What we said was you can't load up the question as though you're summing up the case, put the hypothetical with some number or letter as a fig leaf when everyone knows that you're referring to the defendant.
Right.
That's what we said, correct?
Correct. And that was Detective Belgrave's testimony. Belgrave was the one who was really asked to opine on, given the whole constellation of facts, minus the phones, was the hypothetical suspect, did he possess these drugs with intent to distribute? Whereas Dockery's testimony was more limited. It was more limited to the facts of the phones and whether that was conduct typical of drug distribution, which is, as you said in Kane, you don't even need a hypothetical to provide that kind of testimony.
Going back to the retroactivity issue, how would you state the rule pre-Kane on which you say the state relied?
Pre-Kane, you were allowed to have an expert come in and testify to a hypothetical defendant. Now, there were limitations, which this court went to great pains to set forth in a series of opinions. But by and large, hypothetical testimony that tracked the evidence of the case was permissible, and the expert was then permitted to opine as to whether the hypothetical defendant possessed the drugs with the intent to distribute. That was set forth rather plainly in this court's opinion in Reeds, where you said, as far as proper testimony in this area, that it's useful because, quote, by consolidating the set of facts relied on by the expert, the jury hears the entire basis for the opinion reached about the likely intent or purpose underlying the particular possessory circumstances. And then Reeds further goes on to say that when the proper limitations on this testimony are followed, the expert's testimony, quote, plays a legitimate and valuable role in drug possession and distribution cases by helping the jury in realms unknown and unfamiliar to them when assessing the likely intent of the putative drug trafficker. So if we want to get to the factors for retroactivity analysis, I'm fine with that because I believe we clearly win under those factors too. And the first factor is the purpose of the new rule. The purpose of the new rule here was that, as Kane says, and I'll quote you again, Justice Alvin, that this was meant to do something that you hadn't been successful in doing. You had seen time and time again that this sort of evidence was being misused, that despite all of your efforts to deter this misuse, here you were again, and so therefore those efforts you believed had not succeeded, especially when coupled with the language from Odom that created this sort of contradictory framework. But nevertheless, it wasn't the proper use that you were trying to limit. It was trying to deter misuse. So here, in this case, we believe this testimony was fully appropriate. And so you weren't trying to deter it in all circumstances. So when it's properly used, and from those quotes I just read from Reeds, That's helpful. We're not talking about untrustworthy evidence, which is really what you're concerned with in the first factor of retroactivity analysis. Untrustworthy evidence.
Look, we've said going forward means prospective only. If we go back on that, we've used going forward countless times. It has a meaning.
Exactly.
Put aside Kane. Is that hypothetical, the hypotheticals used here, does it pass muster under other cases that preceded Kane? And Kane was building on the chief's case in Sowell, Reeds, yes, and other cases that were highly critical of hypothetical questions when they were really summarizing the evidence. Go ahead.
Well, I mean,
doing things that going beyond what really fell within the ken of the
jury.
Yes,
I think so. A case like Sowell was problematic because it was telling the jury the obvious. There, it wasn't that it was too detailed. It was the fact that nobody needs an expert to say that dropping something into a bag of potato chips, you know, was a drug transaction. You just didn't need the expert. That fell in line with all of those appellate division cases like Baskerville and Boston that said hand-to-hand transaction is not something a jury needs an expert. McLean said the same thing. Here, this testimony was so far beyond the ken of the average juror that, and Judge Reed certainly didn't abuse his discretion in allowing this in. I mean, I set forth at length the history that of the manner in which this evidence was handled in this case, because I think it shows the great care to which the court and the parties took in handling this evidence. You had the judge acting as a gatekeeper by saying, Belgrave can't testify to this fact, he can't testify to that fact, but he can testify to these things. And then hypotheticals were drawn up ahead of time by the prosecutor for review by the court and counsel. The court then basically took a really heavy-handed approach. I won't say it was too heavy-handed, but quite aggressively excised out pretty much everything the defense attorney wanted excised out from Belgrave's hypothetical in trying to narrow it down. Now, as far as what the terms of that hypothetical are, let's look at what Belgrave testified to. He was allowed to testify to the significance of various facts, including that the suspect had just taken possession of a kilo of cocaine that had just been delivered to his doorstep. The person had $656 on his person, and then he gives the denominations and later gets into the significance of those denominations. But there was no personal use paraphernalia in the person or in the apartment. The significance of the two bags of rubber bands found in his bedroom, the $70,000 in cash, and the various denominations found in his closet, the roll of plastic shrink wrap, the seal-o-meal vacuum storage system, and the heat-sealable bags in the same closet where the seal-o-meal storage system was. Now, all of that was appropriate. None of that was within the ken of the average juror. He didn't ask the expert to opine on the defendant's guilt. They didn't use the language of the statute too closely to opine on guilt. In fact, the language of the hypothetical was specifically approved by counsel himself on that question. So first, let's look at these issues. The possession of a kilo of cocaine is not obvious to the layperson. I've cited cases to that effect, but I'd like to add to them Justice Albin's dissent in Summers, where you had this to say about what would be proper testimony in a drug distribution trial. In the case of an individual caught in possession of a kilogram of cocaine, broken down into hundreds of individual packages, a prosecution drug expert could offer an opinion that the quantity and purity of the drugs and the manner of packaging is inconsistent with personal use. So a kilo of cocaine standing by itself is not obvious to the lay juror. It's not obvious to the lay juror about the amount of cash, particularly given the significance of the denominations and Belgrave's testimony as to that possession of $100 bills and $50 bills denoted a larger scale trafficker.
Are we talking about Dockery or Belgrave now?
I'm talking about Belgrave. I'm going through the Belgrave testimony first, if that's okay.
I think you want to spend more of your time focused on the pure retroactivity question, and here's why, and I invite you to respond to this. At the end of this very detailed hypothetical for Belgrave, where it's obvious that we're talking about the defendant on trial, the question posed is, do you have an opinion as to whether the cocaine in this hypothetical is possessed with intent to distribute, which is precisely what Cain said should not have taken place in cases before have moved us in that direction. So I don't know why you're arguing that it would have been okay as to just a kilo of cocaine, and it would have been okay just as to, you know, the denominations of the bills and so on. They asked this detective for the state of mind of what everyone understood was the defendant, and he answered it squarely.
Right.
So maybe you should focus on the import of the court's language in Cain about prospectivity.
Yes. That's where I said going forward was, is that this sort of opinion testimony that Belgrave gave under Cain, we recognize that testimony would no longer be appropriate. Fully recognize that. That an expert can testify to various facts, but not try and sum up everything. But
pre-Cain,
yes, that was expressly denoted as appropriate, as this court said in Reeves. This court's opinion in Soule didn't change that. Soule said Odom continues to govern, and Odom allowed this sort of thing. You had, in Berry, you had testimony that summarized basically the whole facts of the case. Nobody breathed a word as to whether that was inappropriate or not. And then McLean, you also said Odom continues to set forth the parameters of expert testimony in drug trials. So, yes, post-Cain, yeah, this testimony would not be permitted anymore. But pre-Cain, it consistently was, as long as you adhered to the limitations that this court had put on that sort of testimony. It can't be within the ken of the juror. It can't express an opinion directly on the defendant's guilt, which this did not. It can't track the language of the statute too closely to make it clear that, you know, the expert is opining on guilt, as happened in Reeds, where they talked about constructive possession. Everybody there had constructive possession. You said that tracked too closely. Or the hypothetical in Cain itself, which had built into it, well, he's distributing drugs on this date and that date. So it had built in already the fact that he was a drug distributor. So this, and the reason why I started going through all the components of Belgrave's testimony, is this was in keeping with the case law as it stood at the time. And we had no reason to believe that we were in for a significant change 2 years down the road after this case was tried and the conviction was obtained.
Can I ask you a question? There was a published appellate division opinion, State versus Green, in which the appellate division concluded that Cain was subject to pipeline retroactivity, right?
Yes.
And yet the state did not appeal that. Why not?
I wish they had. I was
because now it's created a class of people who have benefited under that Green decision, and you're asking us now to construe going forward in a common sense way, as you're saying, perspective only. That's what we said in Doc. Mm-hmm. That is going to unsettle all of these cases that have been decided. Some of them may have been retried.
Yeah.
What do we do about that?
I agree, and that's a shame. I wish Green had been petitioned, because I believe Green was just wrong. And through our analysis of the retroactivity factors, I think Green was wrong on all three of them. But we are where we are, and the fact that some defendants may have unfairly benefited from a retroactive application of Cain doesn't mean that other perfectly valid convictions now have to be sacrificed as well.
So let me ask you a question. If we accept your argument that going forward means prospective only, it does not include pipeline retroactivity, would our decision here affect those defendants who benefited under Green? What would happen to them?
I can't say for certain, but I don't imagine that prosecutors' offices would come back and say...
Well, what do you suggest?
I suggest
to that class of people who received the benefit under Green.
I think those convictions are now by the wayside. The fact that there are rulings have already been entered, and if those cases weren't petitioned, and if there are petitions pending before this court now on that very issue, which I don't know one way or the other, then you can deal with those that way. But
so you're saying a prospective ruling should be prospective only? Is that what you're, in essence, saying?
Yes.
Okay.
Can you tell us approximately how many cases were affected by Green?
It's hard to know. It's how many we were able to identify as actually being affected. It's not a large number. But the potential class of cases is, of course, very, very large.
Has a survey been done to estimate that number?
I did not do a survey. I asked the Attorney General's office if they collect data as far as the number of jury trials involving particular sorts of charges, like distribution charges, and they said that data isn't kept. They have overall conviction numbers, but that, of course, includes guilty pleas. So any data on that would be kind of meaningless. But we do know that just based on the raw numbers of arrest records every year in New Jersey, and the fact that this court has seen that drug expert testimony along these lines was a staple in drug distribution prosecutions, that even if you're talking about like 1% or 0.5% of the total number of arrests, you're still talking about a few hundred cases. Now, the fact that we are where we are and maybe a dozen or so have been identified as maybe being adversely affected by a retroactive application of Kane, doesn't mean that other defendants like this one, who got the benefit of the law as it stood at the time, should now be given a windfall and have their cases thrown out as well.
Do you know, are there any cases that are awaiting retrial based on Green?
I don't know. I'm sorry, I don't know that. As far as Dockery's testimony, again, yes, we identified the one aspect of Dockery's testimony that went beyond the four corners of the hypothetical that was ultimately allowed, and that was where he described the use of different area codes of the cell phones used and the significance of that in a drug distribution operation, namely that it's meant to confuse law enforcement and sort of obscure where the various players may be. And in this case, it was undisputed that the five phones that the defendant had on his person, or the suspect in the hypothetical, were five different area codes, four of which were clearly not New Jersey area codes. Two were identified by state. One was an Indiana area code. The other was a Tennessee area code. But while the parties were conferring about now possibly editing down Dockery's hypothetical, the judge rightly said, I'm not sure if you included North Carolina, and the prosecutor wasn't sure one way or the other. And so that all got excised out, possibly a little bit too heavy-handedly by the judge, because the area code testimony was still in the case. But that's where we were. But my response to that is, this was an undisputed, straightforward fact that he was actually in possession, in the hypothetical, of five cell phones with five different area codes. That was no surprise. It was never objected to. And just as the same sort of testimony in Soul was deemed to be harmless error because it was already in the case and it was straightforward, that was not plain error in that case. It shouldn't be plain error in this case. But that gets back to what part of Kane is not retroactive. And that's what pertains to, and that's what informs whether Dockery's testimony could have come in non-hypothetical form. And I think it could have, for the reasons we were talking about before. But the portion of Kane I'm looking to, and I'll read it to you, in holding when hypotheticals are not necessary, when the evidence is straightforward and the facts are not in dispute, so that's what we're talking about here, there's no need to resort to a hypothetical. For example, the expert can explain the purpose and of logos on drug packaging without having to respond to a hypothetical question. The questions can incorporate evidence of record, such as quantity of drugs, which this hypothetical did have, and then coupled with that, the significance of the prepaid cell phones, et cetera, and whether that's consistent with or frequently found in cases involving drug distribution. Again, this is not the hypothetical that's meant to get to the ultimate issue of whether a hypothetical defendant had the purpose to distribute drugs. This was just getting into the significance of cell phone use in drug distribution operations, which Kane says you don't need a hypothetical for. So the fact that they did use a hypothetical here, I think, was kind of a belt and suspenders. They were being as cautious as they could be, knowing the way this court's jurisprudence has evolved on this, and that you do very carefully look at these.
In light of that point that you just made, could we view the use of the hypothetical in this situation as harmless error?
Yes, absolutely. Like I said, it was a belt and suspenders kind of thing that wasn't even necessary. No, that's
in light of the other evidence that was presented.
Certainly, certainly. And certainly, yes, there was overwhelming evidence of guilt in this case. I mean, I don't know if I have to run through it all, but, I mean, our brief lays it out pretty thoroughly, but there was a lot of evidence, including actually possessing a kilogram of cocaine and doing a double take and running when you see the cops behind you. I mean, and with all the packaging, the cash, everything else, it just collectively was overwhelming in this case. And so for those reasons, we ask you to affirm this conviction.
Thank you. Mr. Minguez.
May it please the court. We agree with the state that since this court's 2016 holding in Kane and Sims, that going forward, experts would no longer be permitted to opine as to the defendant's state of mind. The appellate division has seemingly ignored the going forward language and improperly given it retroactive effect. Beyond the going forward language, retroactive application, as the state argued, would not further the purpose of Kane. And both the state and the trial court, like many other courts, since Odom heavily relied on Odom and its progeny, because it was the applicable law before Kane and Sims. The appellate division's improper retroactive application should not go uncorrected. While we do not know the number of cases that are potentially affected, the standard practice before Kane and Sims was to present a hypothetical similar to that presented here. And even if it is a small number of cases, we feel this this error should not go uncorrected. And again, the pivotal consideration is the first factor under Earls, the purpose behind the rule for the retroactivity analysis. And
so can I ask you a question?
Yes.
Assuming we accept your argument that going forward means perspective only, in light of the Green decision, how should this court treat the defendants who relied upon Green?
That we are aware of, I believe there are six cases that applied Green, followed Green and applied pipeline retroactivity to Kane and Sims. And of those six cases, I believe two resulted in a remand. I believe those are older cases. I think at this point.
My question to you is, if we would accept your argument, do we leave those cases alone?
Yes. I mean, at this point, it's. I think those are 2017 cases, I believe, those two cases. So they are what they are at this point.
So if there are cases in which a retrial is pending in light of Green, that trial is the Attorney General accepts that those trials should go forward?
I'm sorry? If Your Honor, can repeat the question?
If there's a remand for a new trial and that trial has not yet been held,
right,
is it the Attorney General's position that trial is to go forward?
Yes, if it hasn't been retried at this point.
And if that's the case, what law governs in those retrials? Kane?
I believe it would be...
You couldn't ask the hypo again.
Right. Yes.
Okay.
But I believe it's just two cases.
Just wanted to be certain about that.
Right. I believe at this point it's probably not an issue since those two cases were decided back in 2017. Just briefly on the writ of replevin in this case, it's our position that that was properly admitted at trial. Here, the defendant's attorney filed an answer and requested a stay. And that stay, we consented to the stay, and it was entered. After the civil division granted the stay, the defendant chose to make a statement in the form of a writ of replevin. The admission of the writ of replevin was properly admitted. Not only did the admission not violate defendant's constitutional rights, but the concerns that the appellate division had in Melendez regarding defendant's knowledge of the consequences of making a statement and his ability to seek counsel were obviated in Coble because defendant had an attorney who adequately protected his rights by filing an answer and requesting the stay.
Now, interestingly, in the answer that was filed, he was referred to as potential claimant.
Yes, he was. And it was a general denial.
Yes.
So in addition to that, defendant never objected to the use of the writ of replevin and instead actively used those statements for his own tactical purposes at trial. And so for these reasons, we would ask that this court reverse the appellate division's decision and reinstate defendant's convictions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Rakoff.
Your Honors, you should affirm the appellate division's remand for a new trial. Two officers improperly opined as experts that my client knowingly possessed cocaine with the intent to distribute. These opinions violated both Kane and pre-Kane case law. So the opinion testimony here was clearly irreconcilable with Kane. Officers Dockery and Belgrave were given facts mirroring all of the real evidence. They pronounced Covo guilty by opining on his state of mind, specifically his knowledge and his intent. These opinions were the ultimate issues for the jury. To quote Kane, an expert's no better qualified than a juror to determine the defendant's state of mind. Ultimate issue testimony intrudes on the jury's domain. It expresses the expert's opinion that the defendant is guilty. No one is fooled by hypotheticals which fail to dissipate any potential prejudice. Now, the state is asking this court to declare that Covo cannot rely on Kane. They want this court, in effect, to overturn Green, which, as you pointed out, from which the state failed to petition in 2016. So the first problem I want to discuss, which wasn't really discussed by my adversaries, it's my contention that there's really no rule of law that's actually being retroactively applied here. So you said in Kane, if I can summarize, that experts shouldn't opine on state of mind as to drugs, because that's a pronouncement of guilt. So I would point you to State versus Reeds, where you essentially, the holding says the exact same thing. Back in 2009, you held that an expert may not decide the ultimate issue of defendant's guilt by opining that defendant constructively possessed the drugs. Well, that is an expert opinion on a defendant's state of mind, its knowledge. It was expressed hypothetically in that case, just as much as in Kane, and it was an ultimate issue for the jury. So when Justice Albin said in concurrence about the majority opinion in Reeds that Reeds cannot be squared with earlier cases letting officers opine on states of mind, it's my contention he was 100% right, that Reeds was a clear departure from previous case law, and that what Kane really did was expound on the rule that was first articulated in Reeds. So regardless, just to move on, it would be grossly unfair to bar Coble from citing Kane. Let's go to the retroactivity factors in regard to what I just contended about Reeves. So the prosecutor here ignored the warning signs. Even after admitting below, the prosecutor admitted below that this court was very wary of ultimate issue opinions. Green was right to hold that Kane cannot be deemed a surprise, and the prosecutor knew that. In Reeves, you warned that Odom is not without boundaries. In Sowell, you warned it can easily appear to the jury that the expert is opining directly about the defendant's conduct. In Nesbitt, you warned that there was no blank check to our willingness to accept the use of hypothetical questions. Second retroactivity factor, Kane enhances the reliability of the jury's fact-finding process. So we rely on juries to sort out the truth. When officers say that defendants are guilty, they taint everything. An officer's verdict is cloaked with authority that many lay jurors won't question. Kane shields the fact-finding process, the jury's fact-finding process, against officers who would unfairly tip the deliberative balance. Third retroactivity factor, that it would be consonant with justice to affirm the appellate division. So Green held that we routinely remand cases for new trials where the trial was unfair. Now, the state, my adversary alluded to there being possibly a few hundred cases affected. So contrary to that argument, there's no flood of reversals coming. The issue only does affect a small number of direct appeals that were pending when Kane was decided in March 2016. Well, it's 3.5 years later. I think the number 6 was mentioned by the Attorney General. And that's correct. You know, I shepherdized Green before argument since March 2016. Kane's been applied, not to say reversed, but just applied, to pending direct appeals only 6 times. And based on my review, Koval was actually the last in April of 2018, a year and a half ago. So the point is that this issue is effectively, we're at the tail end of that issue. So siding with the state would create arbitrary and disparate results given the state's failure to petition from Green. And I would point out, my adversary indicated, I wish that the state had petitioned. Well, I filed a 2611D letter about Green in this case the day it was announced, and there still was no petition. So now we're at the very tail end of those appeals. My client's requesting that basically the courthouse doors not be slammed shot at him at what is essentially the last possible moment for this issue. So it's just happenstance also that Koval wasn't a companion case to Kane. My client was arrested in mid-2010, and it took 8 years to get an appellate division opinion saying that the trial was unfair. Koval and his lawyers were just as much champions of the cause, even below, as were Kane's lawyers and Sims' lawyers. Just a quote from the appellate division opinion, the defense counsel strenuously objected to the use of expert testimony and objected to the hypothetical that tracked factual testimony and appreciated that experts were usurping the jury's constitutional role. So the last point I want to discuss here, that the opinion testimony also violated pre-Kane holdings. So Dockery violated Sowell's warning that the veneer of the hypothetical must not fade. The appellate division agreed. Dockery relied on his role as the lead investigator, failed to abide by a hypothetical, and opined directly on the defendant's conduct. Specifically, he told the jury that he prepared my client's file for prosecution, personally searched the phones, and that, quote, my investigation and, quote, other things that have come out informed his opinion in response to the hypothetical. So the veneer was clearly discarded. Belgrave also violated Coalfield when he opined over the defendant's objection that the money was proceeds from prior drug distributions. So the court didn't do a Coalfield analysis at the time of trial, even though prior to trial, Judge Marino had found that evidence of prior drug distribution would actually be inadmissible because there was no clear and convincing evidence in this case of prior drug distribution, and such evidence, if it did exist, would be grossly prejudicial and outweigh any probative value.
Can we get to Kane for a moment?
Yeah.
Yes. The first thing we have to deal with, tell me if I'm mistaken, is what does going forward mean?
So I read going forward to mean going forward at future trials while silent on the question of whether or not it's applicable to direct appeals, which I presume is already heard of it.
What do you think the term prospective only means? Prospective only. What do you think that means?
Well, I would say that it applies to future cases only.
Only.
Yeah.
Not pipeline retroactivity.
Correct.
Like we know how to use that term. We know how to use full retroactivity. We know how to use pipeline retroactivity, and we know how to use the term going forward. So the case DOC, we specifically said, and that preceded this case. DOC, we said, perspective that going forward means perspective only. So does that mean that Kane does not apply to your case?
No, Kane does apply to my case. The term perspective only appears nowhere in the text of Kane.
If we interpret going forward to mean that, Kane would not apply, of course, right?
Well, if you were to interpret going forward to mean perspective only, then there would not be pipeline retroactivity. And I'm just reading the language. Going forward, in drug cases, an expert witness may not opine on the defendant's state of mind. You know, I interpret that to mean expert witnesses at trials, you know, silent on the question of as to whether or not cases that were pending on direct appeal, such as my client's, received the applicability of Kane.
I'm not understanding that.
Okay.
I thought prospective only means the person or who happens to be the defendant in this case gets the benefit of the case and no one else. That's it. Prospective only. Is that a fair definition?
Yeah, as I understand the case law, that there's the four options that are available to the court, that it can be applied to cases prospective only, that it could be applied to the defendant who's raising the instant action, that it can be applied to pipeline retroactivity,
right.
That it can apply to
okay,
everyone.
We said going forward. Going forward means prospective only. So how does your client get the benefit of Kane? I'm trying to figure that out.
So it's my contention that, as I've indicated throughout my opening statement, first of all, looking at the retroactivity factors, that the purpose of Kane,
Before you get there.
Okay.
Is your argument that going forward is not clear language?
Yes, I do think that it's solid on the question, and that's why we're here today.
So how do you square that with Doc?
So I would say that language is you have to be interpreted in light of the particulars of this case.
I don't understand. Doc says going forward means prospective only. You yourself just said that means doesn't apply to anyone. But maybe the defendant in the case.
So the way that I have interpreted the language going forward as used in Kane is to mean that at trials going forward, I didn't interpret it to bar direct applicability of Kane to cases that are currently
under. We use going forward all the time. So if it has more than one meaning, it's going to unsettle a whole lot of cases. Do you agree?
I take your point there. Yeah.
Are you asking for some sort of more nuanced consideration for your client because your case was more slowly moving through the system, didn't reach an appellate level at the same speed as Kane, but the attorneys for your client were making essentially a similar argument and should not be barred from their relief on direct appeal?
Correct. So I cited several cases in my brief, including Rutherford v. Board of Education. Rutherford v. versus the Board of Education, which essentially says that champions of the cause should get the benefit of...
So the happenstance of timing shouldn't bar your client from having advocates that were making...
Correct.
The same winning argument.
Yeah. So there's
I'm putting words in your mouth, but
right. I mean, there's
wasn't
a happenstance.
Kane the champion of this course, not your client.
So just quoting from the appellate division again below, what happened below, according to the appellate division, and I think is correctly reflective of the record, is that the lawyer below was strenuously objected to the use of the expert testimony. So just to quote some things, counsel argued below that, you know, Dockery was actively involved in the investigation, that there's an unholy alliance, asked the court to apply heightened scrutiny to the ultimate issue testimony here. I mean, this opinion testimony was challenged below. The court itself, in response to defense counsel's concerns below, said, you know, if an expressed confusion. If an expert can't opine as to the defendant's guilt, I'm not quite sure I understand how we can opine on factors which embrace the ultimate issue of the defendant's guilt.
Okay, but if you're relying on Rutherford, didn't Rutherford get where it did by our court not using a retroactivity analysis but using more of a fundamental fairness approach to not barring the advocates there from the benefit of a rule that they were arguing for all along?
Right. I mean, the particulars of the case vary. I also cited another case, I think on the same party. Sorry, I can't remember offhand what it was. It's in my brief. But the main point that I wanted to take from that was as to the administration of justice point in regards to that retroactivity factor. Also, just in regard, again, as has been brought, I don't want to be a broken record on this point, but that that in regard to Green, which the state didn't petition from, as far as the administration of justice point goes, what the state is asking for could result in more work for the judiciary, in a fact that this issue has there are a limited number of direct appeals, and it appeared from the shepherdizing of Green that Roger Colville, like a year and a half ago, his opinion at least appeared to have been the end of the applicability of Kane to cases on direct appeal.
But you're hearing from members of the court questioning you about an interpretation of going forward that unsettles the interpretation our court has given to that terminology. And isn't a fundamental fairness argument a way to avoid unsettling our retroactivity law and get you where you want to go?
Yes, Your Honor.
If we were to agree with that, is this error harmless?
No, Your Honor. The error isn't harmless. So let's talk about that. So at trial, there really was no direct evidence of my client's state of mind, right? So the container was opaque and sealed. The package itself didn't inculpate the defendant. It was addressed from third party to third party. The jury was being asked to speculate about the significance of common household items like phones.
You're saying that his possession of the item didn't incriminate him? He picks up a package that just so happens to have, a kilo of cocaine, and when the police approach him, he throws it away?
So it's an issue for the jury as to what the defendant's state of mind is, right, knowledge and intent. And the experts are putting their thumbs on the scale. There's no direct evidence of my client's state of mind. It's important that the deliberative process be allowed to run its course. In regard to what's found in the house, there's no drugs or contraband that are actually found out in the open. There are also no scales or dilutants found in the house. There were no text or recorded calls showing drug sales or criminal conspiracies. There were no confidential informants here. The state police officer who got the tip about the package testified he had no idea how he got it, right? This isn't a case where there's a CI. There's the allegation of the state that this is all part of a large conspiracy to distribute, but Colville was acquitted by the judge of conspiracy because the state failed to prove its case. That was the subject of a Reyes motion. So I do think, Your Honor, that there's a legitimate question here as to whether or not the jury would have reached the same decision, but for the improper expert testimony. I would suggest looking to State versus Frost, right, where there are two opposing versions to credit, and I think that's what you have.
I'm trying to understand. Okay. Are you saying that there wasn't sufficient evidence that he possessed with intent to distribute, or are you arguing there wasn't sufficient evidence that he even possessed the cocaine?
Both, obviously he was holding the package, but obviously he was holding the package, but I think there's a legitimate question both to his intent and to knowledge.
Knowledge of what was inside the package?
Not knowledge of the contents of the package, yes.
Is that why he threw it as soon as the police came, because he didn't know it was in there?
So, I mean, I would point to the fact that he's being sworn by, multiple police officers at the time. It could be a panic reaction. We don't know what was going through his head. So I would just say, just generally State versus Tucker, when someone's approached by the police in a very scary context, people react in different ways. He reacted by running with the package.
Mr. Rockoff, would you like to address the second issue?
As to the forfeiture point, I would primarily rely on what counsel indicated. Counsel Melendez.
Is this a different case, though? Let me give you this question. You have a forfeiture action that's stayed.
Yes.
Suppose the defendant sends a letter to the court saying, it's my money, I want it back, it had nothing to do with the drugs. Would that be admissible? an action that has been stayed and then a volunteered letter to the court?
So I think the distinguishing feature of this case is that this was a provocation by the prosecutor. So he was, or at least his house was served with
Can you answer my question?
So as I understand your question, the it's in regards to if it was like a sua sponte admission by the defendant without that sort of.
You have a forfeiture action that's begun. The matter is stayed after counsel has interceded, and then a pro se letter directly to the court. Would that be admissible?
No, so a primary part of my contention here today is whether or not the defendant was properly and affirmatively warned by the state prior to the making of any pro se admission. So I note that this.
So if an act has been stayed, as happened in this case.
Yes.
It's still deemed coerced if a defendant volunteers the information as you understand the law?
So what happened here is so the prosecutor indicted my client, then 5 days later wrote to him, right, without warning him that a response would be used against him. And I think that's a critical component that the prosecutor, in my view, and post-Melendez, Melendez, the appellate division held that the defendant must be served by the state with a summons which clearly warns him that the any response he gives to the state can be used against him in the criminal case, which wasn't the case here. So my client responded unwarned by the state and said, these standings are mine and legitimate, and the prosecutor used his response against him.
But before that happens, tell me if I'm mistaken, your client's attorney answers, and a stay was in place. A stay was actually in place at the time that your client issues that writ of replevin. Am I mistaken about that?
You're correct, Your Honor. There was a stay in place. So I would point to what counsel was saying in Melendez about the clear need, and what the AG also said agreed in Melendez that defendants who are served by the state in regard to forfeiture actions must be warned that if they respond to the state, that of the implications for the criminal proceeding. I mean, there's a trap set.
That wasn't even a writ of replevin. It's like a whole new action. That's not even
The appellate division did incorporate into its opinion.
Should the notice also include, and if you file a claim for the money outside of this, you file a writ of replevin, you file some kind of small claims action, it will be held against you. How much should the summons provide for notice?
So I would point to the appellate division's language in Melendez. It says the notice must state that any statements made by the defendant, including in the answer or in a motion to recover the forfeited property, may be introduced in evidence against him or her in a criminal case.
So we understand that. Tell us what weight, if any, you think belongs to the fact that the action had been already stayed by the intercession of an attorney.
I would say it's less important, Your Honor, than the fact that there were no warnings that had been given to the defendant about what would happen if he did respond. So the fact that there's a stay in place doesn't inform the defendant that if he, because the notice that was given to him in the summons only warns him of the consequences of not responding. So as far as he's concerned, even with the stay in place, there's no risk to responding if you go by the straight text of the notice.
Is there any need to respond once a stay is in place?
Well, they've taken what I think most people would agree would amount to like life savings, and you got to imagine that that's eating away at him, regardless of what he understands about the effects of the stay. So I think it is critical for that reason to warn him that there's a coercive effect to holding someone in prison, having their this amount of money being taken away, and advising them that if they want it back, they will need to respond without warning them of the attendant consequences of responding.
Let me just see if I understand. I don't want to belabor this. Do you believe that there is a Fifth Amendment violation in a situation where a stay is in place? Do you believe the answer is in some fashion coerced?
Yes. So I would look to both fundamental fairness and Fifth Amendment. Some of the fundamental fairness language from Melendez that I would point to is that even if not done intentionally, the use of forfeiture to extract admissions violates principles of fundamental fairness.
So you have to explain this to me.
Okay.
Because I see this difference between your case and Melendez. In Melendez, there's no suggestion
that the defendant is having any conversation with his public defender. Here, the attorney for Coville has filed an answer. I have to assume that the attorney is not doing things without corresponding with his attorney, because that would seem to be an RPC
violation.
So
the record, the factual record is limited, but defense counsel represented below that he filed he called it a pro se response on his own from the JO, didn't run this by counsel. So I would point to the language in Melendez that talks about, you know, how incarceration hampers legal advice. But I would also just going back to the Fifth Amendment, I would point out that Coville invoked his right to silence post-arrest. In other words, once he was warned, he chose not to make a statement. So in light of that, had Coville been warned, a response could be used against him criminally, I would make the point that he likely would have made the same choice to remain silent as he made the first time.
I think we understand the position. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Okay, I would just that we request that you affirm the appellate division decision below and remand for your trial. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Heinzel, brief rebuttal.
I guess it was my fault that I didn't address the Replevin issue before. If I could just do that briefly. I think there were some factual assertions made in the papers that just don't bear out. I mean, this whole claim proceeded without anybody challenging this really at all. This is something that the defense affirmatively embraced for tactical reasons. The only issue at the 104 hearing was whether this was an adoptive admission, and they conceded that it was. Nobody breathed a word about Fifth or Sixth Amendment violations, about direct contact with a represented defendant. Nobody thought that. And this was Michael Rogers. He's now a judge. He's an extremely capable and, in this case, aggressive attorney. He put the state's case to the test. I mean, you had a lengthy suppression motion. You had 404B issues. You had severance issues. You had dismissing counts. You had excluding all the testimony about Christopher Hartley. You had this case whittled down. And on this issue, he was like, sure, bring it in as long as the whole document comes in under the doctrine of completeness. He wanted that because it allowed his client's version, which he even told the jury this was sworn testimony because it was a certification. It gave a neutral explanation for the drugs, which was part and parcel of his larger theme that the state is trying to fool you with all these innocent items, and, you know, here we have the only evidence, and that's the statement of my client. And that I have affirmative evidence, they have nothing. So he affirmatively embraced this. There was no Sixth Amendment violation. They never said there was. And in fact, I think you need to look at what they're relying on. They're relying on the language from the summons, which was addressed to Coville at 308 Coventry Lane. But here, what we've provided to the court is the acknowledgement of service. While the defendant's in the jail, acknowledgement of service is by defendant's mother at 308 Coventry. 9 days later, Rogers files the answer. There's nothing in that record that says, you know, that those documents went to the defendant. For all we know, Mrs. Coville could have called up Rogers and said, hey, I got this. And Rogers could have said, I got it. I'll handle it. And sure enough, nine days later, he did.
So counsel is arguing the notice didn't provide adequate information. Why don't you tackle that head on?
I'll tackle that directly, because the compulsion from a forfeiture complaint is to answer the forfeiture complaint. Once that answer was filed, the compulsion was over. It was doubly over once a stay was put in place with the state's consent. So there was no compulsion. There was nothing even remotely equating to something that's the functional equivalent of an interrogation. By the time a month after the stay is put in place, Coville drafts this document and sends it to our office and then tries to file it. And as I said, there was not a word, not a breath of any constitutional violation at the hearings by an attorney who most certainly would have aggressively done so, I think, from this record you could tell, if he had had any concerns whatsoever. As I said, he embraced this document. It was part and parcel of his strategy. And this was really for something that
wasn't... Was it really part and parcel of strategy? Because as I read the record, it comes up in summation. It hasn't been mentioned before. It was just moved into evidence as a document admission put in. And, you know, one could look at that summation and view it as defense counsel doing the best that he can to make something that could be damning look positive for defendant before the state stands up and uses it however they're going to use it in their summation.
Actually, he mentioned it affirmatively in his opening statement, too. So if you look at Mike Rogers' opening statement, okay, he makes the same references to the writ of replevin and explains to the jury what it is.
He was able to give an innocent explanation for the money that you were using in the hypothetical to show that he was a drug dealer.
Exactly. Exactly.
So he was able to neutralize it. Okay.
Right. He did that from his opening on. And even if you look at that transcript, which is 12T, which is when the openings are given, at the beginning of that transcript, before openings are given, Rogers asks for the state to stipulate that that's his room. He wanted the state to actually stipulate and agree that that's his room because he wanted to limit the nature of documents found in that room. If I stipulate, I can pare back some of the state's evidence. The state said, we're not willing to stipulate, but we will pare back our presentation to some degree. So this was a foregone conclusion in his mind anyway. And then the way he questioned witnesses, he said, now, it's true, isn't it, that my client lives at 308 Coventry? Right. He had his driver's license. That was his address. You had various documents in the room that were his. So he obviously weighed this document, saw, look, I'm already cooked on this is my house, this is my room. I might as well make the best of it and affirmatively use it. And I think that's what the record shows.
Thank you. And thank you to all counsel for the helpful argument.